Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 21st of January. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Mosby.
And the UK has been braced with a real cold snap this week. Glorious blue skies in winter is a much finer than a sunny winter's day. Wrap up warm. Let's have a look at some of the news this week. Again, it's been dominated by the post office accounting scandal, which we kind of talked about last week. This time, Fujitsu's Europe CEO, Paul Patterson, has acknowledged the company's moral obligation to compensate sub-postmasters who are wrongly accused and prosecuted due to the faulty IT software provided by the firm. Fujitsu had given evidence to the post office that led to the prosecution of innocent managers, and the company's involvement has been seen as contributing to one of the most widespread miscarriages of justice in British history. The global CEO of Fujitsu, Takehito Takita, issued an apology and expressed the company's serious approach to the issue, although he did not confirm whether Fujitsu would return any money earned from the faulty system. I think they've since come out and said that they actually would or will compensate the victims, but only after the kind of like the hearing, the inquiry into the government's inquiry into the post office scandal. So that was good to see actual Fujitsu coming out and putting the hand up and saying, look, you know, we were responsible and we wronged them. So bit more progress on that one. The other news, again, you probably saw this, Trump's win of the Iowa caucuses. Donald Trump's decisive victory in the Iowa caucuses solidified his dominant position within the Republican Party, his historic margin of victory securing the most votes in almost all of Iowa's counties, highlighted that this is still very much Donald Trump's party. Trump appeal extends across age groups, genders, and conservative factions, including evangelicals and hard-right conservatives. The fact that he convinced a large majority of caucus-goers that he was a true winner of the 2020 presidential election underscores his enduring influence. Trump's victory in Iowa is a remarkable turnaround considering the controversies of his first presidential term, culminating in the January 6th Capitol riot. While he still faces legal challenges, this win marks a significant step towards securing the Republican Party's nomination for the 2024 presidential election. Trump's main rivals, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, failed to emerge as a clear challenger, leaving the field divided. So what are your thoughts on this? And are you surprised that Trump's won the caucuses?
Not surprised at all. I was listening to a Russell Brand thing yesterday, and he was basically talking about this, and it's like, there isn't another Republican candidate that anyone's interested in. So, yeah, and it looks like Biden has something like 69 or 70% of even Democratic voters basically don't think Biden's mentally or physically up to it. So, you know, who's he going to be competing against? I don't know. So,
do you think Biden has gifted this one to him, you know, in that respect? Because the way I see Biden at the moment is, you know, they're saying it's a 50-50 split. Obviously, this critical win for Trump in Iowa is has sort of probably swung that around. But ultimately, Biden and his lack of, I think you mentioned it last week, his lack of kind of involvement or desire to do anything in with Israel-Palestine conflict. And I think you were right to address that last week. The Western world are just almost turning a blind eye. A lot of the Muslim voters in the US have switched on back. They've gone like, how can we support this guy? He's supporting this war. He's supporting Israel's actions. And actually, a lot of people have lost. And they're the ones who probably would have been staunch Democrats have now switched and gone to the vote for, you know, that they're looking to Trump, which you never would have heard. It would have been unheard of 2-3 years ago, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because I think Trump will probably stand up to the Israelis to a point anyway. This is the issue, isn't it? I mean, still, it's such a divisive subject and it's such a divide down the middle situation, you know.
So what do you think those look like? You know, Trump's come out and he's vocally and he said he will fix Ukraine in a day, the Russia-Ukraine situation in a day. We know we saw him with Putin in sort of 2019. He's got good relation or purported good relationships with Russia. Would he go in and negotiate a deal, a land deal for Russia?
Who knows? But I mean, he's all full of crap, isn't he? Nothing can be negotiated in a day. Nothing.
The thing that worries me is his talk of disbanding NATO. He's talked about that, hasn't he? He said that NATO would be no more. He's a big threat to the Western world in terms of disbanding NATO. And do you think the world will be a safer place with Trump in charge?
I don't think the world's a safe place, full stop. I don't think Trump being in charge is going to make much of a difference, to be honest. I mean, I think the difference is that you will find wokeism being removed, I think, rather fast from the U.S., And I think he said it first time around, wasn't it? He's gonna empty the swamp. The problem with U.S. politics is it's not a democracy at all. It's about who has the most money to spend on basically furnishing money towards politicians and people who are trying to make things go their way. It's a strange system, democratically. I think it's possibly one of the least democratic countries in the world now in terms of the way that it's voted. There's only a few states that actually really matter because all of the other states, first past post system that they have, it's bizarre. It's a very, very strange system. And we don't like our system either, but at least our system is, I think, a lot more democratic. But still, it turns itself around to only swing seats that make a difference. Everything else doesn't make a difference. So, there's all sorts of talk about, well, would proportional representation be better and so on and so forth. Well, that way, even in the UK, you'd never have a majority. You'd have Labour 30%, Conservative 35%, and the rest something else. So, and this is also, and I'm going around the world here, but this is also the problem in Israel. Is that in Israel, the democratic system is broken as well. It's badly broken.
Absolutely. I think another 4 years of Trump's is sort of America first diplomacy will destroy the country's already declining global power. I just think that it's just going to lead to that.
Could do. But I mean, it's on the decline anyway. That Trump, Biden, DeSantis, whoever, it's on the decline of this, there is no doubt. And when they realize that, which they haven't yet, then we'll see what happens. Because if you think about it from a Trump point of view, what is he doing? He's basically trying to stem and fight against that loss. So we will see.
So the other news this week, which caught the headlines, was the Prince of Wales visited his wife, Catherine, in hospital where she's recovering from successful abdominal surgery. She's reportedly doing well, recovering after a second night in the London Clinic private hospital. Queen Camilla's also confirmed the King, who's set to have a procedure for an enlarged prostate, is fine. So two sort of potential operations. One seems to have been carried out with Catherine, but obviously the big one is the King, isn't it? The fact that he's come out and talked openly about his health issues, or which looks like a routine procedure for an enlarged prostate. But you got to be commendable. It's pretty commendable that he's come out and talked about this, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good that he's saying it. I think it's good from the point of view that everyone else will also look at it and say it's okay to talk about these things. So that's good. Yeah.
Other news, Russia is considering terminating the long-standing agreement dating back to 1956 that allows British boats to fish in the Barents Sea, a move that could threaten the supply of cod and haddock for fish and chips in the UK. The Russian government has submitted draft legislation to ban UK boats from fishing in this area, which is famous for cod and haddock. Last year, up to 40% of cod and haddock consumed in the UK came from Russia and Russian territory. The move is seen as weaponizing food and comes after 2 years of high fish prices in the UK due to the war in Ukraine. While it may not have a huge impact on UK fish and chip shops, it raises concerns about global implications of such action. The draft bill to scrap the agreement has the support of Russia's government. So with a good amount coming from the North Sea as well, of course. But what are your thoughts on that news as someone who's a big foodie and likes good fish and chips?
Yeah, it's not good, is it? I mean, again, there's so many geopolitical issues going on that it's hard to know, really, isn't it? It's hard to know what's
weaponizing food.
Weaponizing food. Yeah, fish and chips, that's really hitting at the heart of the British soul.
So, I mean, we've got a good amount coming from the North Sea, and obviously the Irish Sea is known for its fisheries, those specials like cod, haddock, plaice, whiting and herring. And I mean, it's been historically important fishing area for both the UK and Ireland. Also an area that near where I grew up in Morecambe Bay, and you see that the cockle and, you know, the cockles and
mussels and
and obviously shrimp fisheries as well. Morecambe Bay potted shrimp is fantastic. So you see what I did there, Kev?
And if you stick a big stick in the sand and give it a squiggle, then you'll get some gas coming up, I guarantee. Okay,
well, so you see what I did there, Kev? We've gone from Morecambe Bay shrimp, segueing nicely into this week's guest company. This company is an emerging player in the field of clean energy solutions, focusing on providing low-emission energy solutions to meet the increasing demand for clean energy in the UK as it strives to achieve its net zero goals. The company recently gained admission to AIM through a reverse takeover with Dial Square Investments, marking its presence as the only energy company admitted to AIM in 2023, even amidst challenging market conditions. The company aims to progress its Marram project to final investment decision, FID, in 2024, with the project holding significant potential as a low-emission gas field in the UK Irish Sea, featuring substantial reserves and contingent resources. The company's strategic approach involves near-term development of low-emission gas projects while focusing on long-term energy transition solutions. It aligns with the UK's emphasis on domestic gas to support energy security and the transition to a net zero economy. The company also holds a first mover advantage in the East Irish Sea region, a promising area for low emission gas reserves that can contribute to energy transition opportunities, including hydrogen production and carbon capture and storage. With a strong foundation and commitment to sustainable energy solutions, the company is well positioned to play a pivotal role in the UK's evolving energy landscape. We welcome Energy Pathways, Ben Klube, CEO, Mark Steeves, Chairman, and Ben Hodges, CFO. Welcome, gents.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Very pleasure to be here.
Well, after Phil's introduction, it reminds me of Johnny Farpants from Viz. Do you remember that? We're talking about gas.
gas. So let's wind back the clock and start with how Energy Pathways was conceived, with a little bit about both of your or all of your backgrounds and why clean energy and why the Irish Sea.
Yeah, sure. So, well, so it's Ben Klube here. Yeah. So, well, my background is I've been in the oil and gas sector throughout my career. Much of that was with a company called BHP Petroleum, where I was vice president of finance, and I'm really in that role. I've working internationally across all geographies, really, but much of it was in gas development and gas commercialization. But during that career, I was very much involved in taking some gas fields in this particular geography you mentioned, the UK Irish Sea, from development and into production, and those are the Liverpool Bay gas fields. So I have a strong familiarity with this particular region of the UK CS, Continental Shelf, and that's what's drawn my attraction to it and the company's attraction to it. After BHP, my career was small cap companies in the energy sector across the world, and we've had a number of successes in that journey. In the recent years, I've turned my attention to what I thought were new opportunities. So we're going to come out of the energy sector, coming out of the energy transition space. And myself and the team who've worked with me in previous companies, we were looking at what we thought were opportunities that would arise. And we're very much driven towards gas as the place to focus. And it's gas assets which could be brought into market in relatively short cycle times, but could deliver low emission energy solutions and potentially be integrated with other energy assets to reduce emissions. So that was the starting point of Energy Pathways. So it's a special purpose vehicle set up for delivering low emission energy solutions and providing the UK with essentially energy security and low emission energy.
Very good. And what about yourself, Mark?
Well, I was introduced to Ben about 2 years ago, a mutual friend. I've worked in the oil field service sector predominantly since about 1981, too. I started with a ship brokerage company, and what immediately caught my attention when I was introduced to Ben and he told me about the project was that at that time, that ship brokerage, we had two ships which were on charter to British Gas in Morecambe Bay, and new ships were built and chartered at that time for the development of the Morecambe Bay field. You know, it's been going a long time, 40 years, I guess. It's a long time. Very, very big fields. But it caught my imagination. As I say, I worked in the oilfield service sector, several different industries. Latterly, during the early 2000s, I worked in insurance, insuring oilfield operations around the world. And as my career comes, if you like, towards the end, I've been picking up non-exec directorships, and this one caught my attention very much.
So is this a high-risk or a low-risk play from your insurance point of view, Mark?
Relatively. You can't insure enterprise. No, this is not a high-risk endeavor. None of it, actually.
Because it's in shallow water?
Because the risks have been taken. You know, the wells have been drilled. In the case of Marram, you know, it's fully proven. It's ready to rock and roll.
Very good.
Okay, now we have confusion here because we have two Bens. So tell us a bit about the second Ben.
Shall we call him Benji?
Yes, Ben Hodges, my name. I am the CFO of Energy Pathways. I've had about 20 years in experience in the extractive industries, oil and gas, as well as mining. Been involved with the small cap sector for about 15, 16 years of those 20 years. I've had experience working for companies listed on a variety of exchanges, the ASX in Australia, TSXV in Canada. And of course, the AIM market in the UK. And much like Mark, I was actually introduced to Ben Klub about 2 years ago. And I've been involved with Energy Pathways since. There's a lot of work on our journey to IPO, which we're all heavily involved in. And looking forward to, now we're listed, to developing the assets, which is a great opportunity. Because again, as Mark has already articulated, it's not an exploration play, it's development.
Very good. That brings up a good point. How much skin in the game do you all have, Ben, through Mark and Ben? Give us an idea of how much invested or how invested you are in this project.
Very, very invested. Ben will give you the sort of the combined numbers, but the board of management have a significant holding in this company. And personally,
that's right.
Very invested. I put a lot of money into this company and obviously sweat and tear.
Yeah. Absolutely. Board of management account for about 18.5% of the company at the moment.
Yeah, well, just talk us through, because obviously this was an RTR, as I alluded to earlier on, with Dial Square. Do you want to just talk us through some of the how that happened, came about, and how you identified that, and also why Marram was brought on board and Energy Pathways? And also, I think there was a certain number that from the deck, was like 85% of existing shares were locked in.
So how the original asset, the Marram asset, was brought into the company, that was a transaction that we did pre-IPO. As I described earlier, we were looking for what we thought were the right asset opportunities. What attracted us to the Marram gas project was the fact that it was a fully appraised, proven gas field that simply just needed to be taken forward to development. That's why that was the foundation asset that we thought was very attractive. And because of that, we thought it could be developed and brought into market in a relatively short cycle time. So no appraisal drilling needed and so on and so forth. So that was how we identified the asset, and the transaction was the asset was held by a private company, UK company, that essentially was sort of exploration strategy of nature, and they really needed a company with the wherewithal to take it forward. And so we were really the right company for them to do that. So we acquired it 100% from that private company, and that's where we are today. In terms of the I think the lock-in question you had there, circa 85% of the pre-money shareholding base was locked in either through a sort of hard lock-in structure, orderly market type agreement structure. There's a variety of arrangements, but fundamentally it's sort of demonstrating the commitment of the pre-money shareholders to the company and the value proposition that's being put forward.
So, Ben, did the company you sold Marram to, Energy Pathways, did they take cash, or did they take part of Energy Pathways as part of the deal?
The structure of the acquisition deal was a small cash consideration and a royalty structure whereby the royalty payments that they receive come out of merit reduction, but it's not trying to make it all sound too complicated, but those royalties, you know, reasonably small and only kick in when the project has actually paid back its investment.
Okay, very good. So ultimately, they're really not going to get paid unless it succeeds.
Absolutely, yep.
Which is good. Okay, so tell us a little bit about the technical side of this situation. Then we've got a gas deal. We know roughly where it is, obviously off the coast of northwest of England. Tell us the difference between, you know, how much gas is there, how much is proven, how much is still possible above proven, if that is the case. Just give us an idea.
Yeah, sure. So firstly, we're dealing with a gas resource of in a mid-case sense, it's in the order of 45 billion cubic feet of gas, sales gas. It is a gas resource which is located in shallow water and a short distance from existing pipeline infrastructure, gas infrastructure. So what that means is that the cost to develop a gas resource of this type is relatively low cost, given it's in shallow water and it's a short distance to link it in to transportation and access to the UK market. The other thing to maybe note is that the reservoirs that we're producing out of are exceptionally good quality. And we know that because there are other producing gas fields very nearby, the Mariam gas field. And so we have a lot of analog or comparative data that tells us that these reservoirs will produce very well. Excellent recovery factors in the order of 85%. So we have a high degree of confidence in the production that can be expected from the Mariam reservoirs. And that high degree of confidence is founded on the fact that it's already been drilled, but with appraisal wells. And we've actually covered it all in 2D seismic and reprocessed that all. So we understand the shape of the structure of the reservoir that we're dealing with very well.
Okay, my next question is then, we're living in a world where we're going through this transition, and obviously this is one of Energy Pathways' unique selling points, if you like, is that, one, how green is this gas, if you like? So in other words, how does it affect the environment that we use this gas? And secondly, when the gas is pumped out, what is then the potential use of these offshore reservoirs?
So good question. So one of the reasons that attracted us to this particular region is the ability to essentially generate low emission energy supply. Now, the Mariam gas field resource has a very, very low carbon footprint. And the other thing to note is that the UK gas market is transitioning in its own right rapidly, and that it is increasingly, UK gas demand is increasingly being met by imports. And when we say imports, the UK is increasingly using imported LNG to meet its demand. And that position, or that situation, is being exacerbated, you know, sort of year on year, to the extent that by the end of this decade, 80% of UK gas demand will be met by imports. And as I've mentioned before, much of that is going to be LNG imports, and that's going to come from various destinations, but including the US, Qatar, by example. Now,
Just explain what happens between LNG gas imports and, let's say, they come from the pipeline from Norway or wherever it happens to come from. Well, what is the difference?
Yes, exactly. That's what I was just about to explain. So the emissions that come out of a gas field like Mariam are very, very clean. So you need just very few emissions associated with producing that gas. However, imported LNG has very high emissions, to the extent that Mariam gas is effectively 15 times better from an emissions perspective relative to imported LNG. So what we think is very attractive for UK and the UK energy market is that by bringing Mariam gas into the UK energy supply, we will have an immediate and a significant contribution to reducing the UK carbon footprint.
And what happens to the reservoirs then? Is the possibility of some financial benefit for using the reservoirs in the future?
Yes. So again, good question. So when one of our plants here in, as part of the strategic plans for the energy transition here, is the reservoirs that we've identified in Marram, and we'll talk about some lookalikes, I think, a bit more in the conversation, but these reservoirs are excellent for gas storage and actually hydrogen storage as well. So once we've depleted, produced the gas reserves from the Marram field, this reservoir will be excellent for gas storage. Now, I'm sure yourselves and your listeners fully aware that the UK has very limited capability for gas storage, and the demand for gas storage in the UK is going to clearly increase as it becomes increasingly reliant on imports. So we think we're supremely well located from a gas storage perspective for these reservoirs to be reused because, again, good quality reservoir, close to infrastructure, and so they can be essentially stored at a low-cost LNG environment and then produced when demand is required in the UK market.
And how would Energy Pathways financially benefit from that?
Well, there's essentially a market for gas storage, and we would be looking to develop the field in a manner that it can be reused for gas storage. That's not a very complicated thing to do, and we would be able to offer up our energy storage to the market.
And from the point of view of the Marram field, this 45 BCF or billion cubic feet of gas, how long will that take out of the ground once you finally...
It's a relatively fast producing field in the order of 6 to 7 years.
Okay. What sort of, at the current rate of gas, the current cost of gas, how much is that 45 BCF actually physically worth in revenue?
So probably best answered in that we would value from a net present value perspective that production profile and of this project is being something in the order of £100 million.
Okay, and £100 million is the value after all the costs are paid?
No, that's from today.
From today. So explain where you get the £100 million from, if you don't mind.
Well, it's a combination of the cost of investment to develop the gas project, which we've indicated to the market. So we estimate could be in the order of £70 million, and then it's the net cash flows of the production from the field in a cumulative manner, added up in a cumulative manner.
So the net cash flows over 6 or 7 years, you expect to be in excess of £170 million?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about how this will progress then. I mean, here we are, you have a market capitalization of £6 million, you're talking about having a net present value of £100 million, bit of a difference. Where do we go from here?
Well, you asked a question about risk in some ways. So what I think is neat about this particular project is it's a fully appraised gas reserve, and the journey to convert that reserve to generate excellent returns for investors is a relatively sure one. So our next workflow steps is to take the project from where it is today and complete our development plan and get approval for that development plan from the government, so we can then proceed with our development. And that involves completing front-end engineering design type work, so designing what the development looks like, completing all the necessary approvals such as environmental approvals, which we're well progressed with. And then we make a final decision to proceed with the development, which is called an FID decision, and we proceed with the development. Now, the nature of the development, as you've probably already appreciated, is simple because we are in shallow water, and so we'll be drilling two wells and tying those back to the existing infrastructure via a subsea pipeline. Because it's a relatively simple development, we think we can complete that development in a relatively short time frame, something in the order of 12 to 18 months. And so we have the prospect of getting into first production and supplying the UK market with essentially a low emission secure energy supply by the end of 2025.
And just talk us through the licensing aspect of that, Ben or Mark, in terms of, so I think that there's currently license requests that are progressing with the UK government. And we've already stated in previous talks that the UK government are extremely committed to maximising the production of UK oil and gas. And so presumably they're very cooperative on the licensing side of things, are they?
Yeah, we've had a very good experience on the licensing. And as I said before, we're well advanced with some of the approvals associated with the development project. We're actually in the final phase of the approval process for Marram with the government regulator who are called the North Sea Transition Authority. And from the environmental approvals, we anticipate that we will complete that process sometime in the next 6 to 9 months.
Okay. And there's also other assets or other, like say, fields within this region. Do you want to just talk us through, is it Knox, Lowry and Castletown as well that were on the slide as well in terms of, and also the numbers around the BCFs around those, please?
Yeah, sure. So look, we're not in this exercise just for Marram, the Marram Gas Project. We see a lot of further growth potential in this region, but delivering on the same objectives that I've already stated, delivering energy security and delivering clean energy supply to the UK. And in a similar fashion, these other resources we've identified, we believe will deliver the exceptional returns to shareholders that we've already discussed. So as part of that exercise, we're moving quickly and we have license requests in with the government regulator already, and we're hopeful of hearing back in relation to certain of those within the next 6 months. We're also looking at other opportunities to acquire additional resources in this basin, and we think we have a first mover advantage. We have a deep knowledge of this region that I think gives us an understanding of the potential that maybe others do not have. And we're looking to take advantage of that knowledge base as soon as possible.
Sure. And so would the idea be to get Marram online and then bring on the others sort of in a serial fashion? Or would it be possible to bring them on sort of two at a time or three at a time? Do you see what I'm saying? Is the NPV based, the 100 million that we've talked about, based on just the Marram asset? Or is that on the multitude of, you know, all three of the other assets?
Yeah, to answer your questions in reverse here, so the NPV is based on only development. Are there opportunities or synergies that exist with it and other resources? Absolutely. And part of our journey will be to, let's say, explore how we maximize those synergies for our shareholders. But, you know, just as one would expect that we should do. So, you know, with an eye to also recognizing that funding growth we see coming out of operational cash flow substantially. So exactly where we end up and how we phase this is yet to be determined. But there is considerable synergies, I think, to be exploited.
Very good. So Ben, CFO, let's talk about the finances. What is the situation in terms of the £70 million that is required then to develop the field? How do you propose that you're going to get that?
Sure. I mean, the company has a range of options available to it, but one method of financing we have been looking into is a combination of debt and equity, with debt making up 70% of the CapEx cost. And the Marram project is attractive to a debt lender due to the tight reserves range. And yeah, that would be the major component of the financing solution.
Okay, and on financing, and then obviously, as Ben alluded to, you could be producing gas by the end of 2025. How quickly will that debt be paid back?
Well, quite quickly. I think it's within 12 months. We generate a lot of cash within the for the life cycle of production, actually. So the debt payback time is actually quite short.
Okay. And what is the internal rate of return on the Marram project alone?
Circa 70% return. So it's a quick payback with a high rate of return.
Okay. So have you come across projects like this with this sort of percentage of internal rate of return? Because in stuff we've looked at, I've never really seen 70% before, to be honest.
No, I mean, this is one of the characteristics that when I was sort of first introduced to the company that really attracted me to the proposition. It's somewhat different to many other sort of, I suppose, early stage or young companies. We've got a hand on an asset that is more developed, and an added advantage that we do have is that being in shallow waters, it makes our drilling capex costs less than other offshore projects.
I'm still trying to place your accent, Ben. Where are you from originally?
Ben's English. Ben's English. He's English.
No, you're not English. You sound either Australian or South African.
He doesn't want to be reminded.
He has spent so much time in those places.
I've been over here for 25 years, but I was born in Australia. Very much my home.
For sure. But the question is, if England play Australian cricket, who are you supporting?
That's a very good question here.
Let's pick my sport. So,
It varies.
Depending on who I'm with, my mood.
And who's winning?
Exactly.
Who's winning? That's basically sitting on the fence, Ben. Really,
yes, it is.
I mean, if you're Australian, you're Australia. That's what you've got. I didn't even mind any of this else, boy. Anyway, all good. So in recap, what we've got here is we've got a system with 45 billion cubic feet of gas, which boy do the UK need. It's 15 times better from a point of view of bringing it out in terms of the environment. And on top of that, you have a 70% internal rate of return, which for me is unheard of. I haven't seen anything like this. 20, 30, 40%, yes. 70% seems absolutely exceptional. You obviously have to raise the money, and 70% of that will come from lending. 30% will eventually come from equity down the line. But to be valued at £6 million, is there a reason why you came to the market at such a low valuation?
I think to make it's a very attractive proposition to investors. So relatively low risk gas development project, delivering low emissions, energy security, and I think it's very attractively priced for investors.
Can I also say that it's repeatable? Phil has wanted to hear more about the other fields that we've identified, that we've got bids in to develop. They're similar, you know, on the other side of the country in the southern North Sea. They're frequently talking about what are referred to as stranded assets, right? These are not stranded. They're right alongside infrastructure which allows them to be developed, and they're in shallow water. That's really what differentiates. And so this 70% return is just on Marram. It's repeatable.
I mean, we're always used to hearing the likes of, you know, around the North Sea gas that all the easy stuff has been taken.
That's right.
Fractured basin, it's all very heavy, you know, that sort of thing. But actually, I wasn't
aware. Technically quite demanding. You know, it's technology.
And FPSO and all that sort of thing required, as we know. And it's very costly, as you say. But I'm surprised, and that's why I am a little bit shocked that fields like this exist in this current climate, to be honest.
This is to do with the historical association that the area had with latterly Centrica, which is a publicly listed company, but before that by a state-owned utility, British Gas. And it was their backyard, and nobody else was there. That's why.
Yeah.
Simplistically.
So it's almost like a cookie cutter model in the sense that you bring Marram online and then the rest should follow, you know what I mean, in a similar vein, right?
That's right. The development approach to many of these undeveloped gas resources discoveries in this basin are the same. It's a shallow water environment and it's a tieback type development.
Absolutely. So the other thing, we talked about the storage side of things, and I alluded at the top of the introduction about carbon capture, hydrogen production. Do you want to just add a little bit about how those other sort of growth opportunities may arise?
Yeah, sure. So we think this region is really, really exciting from an energy transition perspective, because besides there being significant undeveloped gas resources in this basin, it also contains or is close to other energy assets and those include some renewable wind generating capacity, very large for the UK, in the order of 7 to 8 gigawatts of existing and planned wind generating capacity. It also has the UK's leading carbon capture storage project, which is the Liverpool Bay depleted gas fields, which are off the north coast of Wales.
You worked at
which I actually worked on, yes, previously. Yep. And it also has the UK's leading hydrogen hub, which is HyNet Northwest, which is based around the industrial and high population area of Manchester and Liverpool. We also have other carbon capture and storage reservoirs, potential and hydrogen hub projects being planned on this northwest region of England. So there's a great opportunity here to integrate effectively these assets together. And energy transition is all about integration. And so we really see this as a unique environment whereby these assets can be integrated together to generate a low emission energy supply for the UK. And we see great prospects for this being a major energy supply centre for the UK.
Do you want to explain the difference between blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, what it's for?
So very, very good point, Mark. So probably should have said the hydrogen hub projects that exist and are being developed, they're going to be driven by blue hydrogen, at least initially. And that means they're going to be the feedstock to produce the hydrogen is going to come from natural gas. So we're in the right place to be providing that feedstock. So I guess we see in the energy transition space, a number of markets that exist for the gas that we produce, be it blue hydrogen, be it the gas grid into the UK, which is clearly gas short. And also, furthermore, gas power generation is going to be essential to back up renewable power generation. So we see great opportunities for our gas.
Very good. And just to go back and focus very quickly just on the share structure, I mean, basically, based on what you've said in terms of what is locked up and what is not tradable, I mean, we're basically talking about somewhere in the region of £1 million of your stock is tradable in terms of the market at the moment. So from an ability to buy this stock, it could get very interesting if things start to, if people start to buy the stock.
When they do, not if.
Okay, I was sitting on the fence, but when?
Yeah, look, so I think we've got a lot of news flow and a lot of things happening in a relatively short time frame that I think would appeal to investors. And we've already talked about the, you know, the value gap and the what I think was very attractive pricing at IPO. But in the lead up to our final investment decision, there's going to be milestones on the road to achieve that. We're expecting to hear news in relation to the environmental approvals, government approvals. We're expecting to hear a news flow on new license awards and additional resources, and also news flow with respect to partnerships in and around the clean energy technology space. So we've got a busy few months ahead of us, but we're expecting to be reporting to the market some quite exciting developments.
Good answer to your question. So I'm going to come to each one of you then, and maybe we start with Ben, CFO. Give us your quick take on why the people would want to have a look at Energy Pathways.
We're a de-risked project that's undervalued, in a nutshell.
Great. Good answer.
You can't answer shorter than that.
Okay. Mark, I'm fairly confident you can't answer shorter than that, but let's try.
I think every true Briton has a responsibility to buy this stock.
Okay, that now Ben, who's quite obviously not from Britain.
Yeah, look, I think this is a great opportunity in an emerging opportunity space, which is all about energy transition. And I think there's growing awareness within the UK and governments and regulators that there's an energy challenge on here and we've got the right solution.
Can I just actually add rather more seriously about the patriotic responsibility of every true Brit? In truth, we are shooting ourselves in the foot when we don't develop our own assets, especially in these circumstances when we are so unready for the kind of deadlines that we've given ourselves to electrify everything and so on and so forth. This is actually, I don't really much like the phrase, but it is a no-brainer.
Yeah. Do you think, when did we become so unpatriarchal in terms of Like, no, genuinely, it's like, is it just globalization on a massive level that's led to sort of this capitalism? I don't understand how there's been such
this is the kind of investment. This is the kind of conversation you have in a pub when you've had a few beers. But I think that I really do think we've lost touch with some realities. I think that's what's happened. You know, the war in Ukraine has been a huge wake-up call, and I don't say we're pleased it's happened, good Lord, but it has made us realize that we cannot expect the rest of the world to help us along at no price. And that's what the consequences of, that's why the gas prices accelerated, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, most of the LNG is going to Germany, replacing all that Russian gas that was coming in. Yeah. And so it just isn't... Yeah, and there you go.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to wrap up, Kev, on what we've talked about now?
Yeah, well, we've got to ask the very important question, because you're on the Sunday roast, obviously, is, you know, if you had your perfect situation, what would be your choice of Sunday roasts? And I think, again, we'll start with Ben CFO.
That would have to be a roast chicken.
Oh, that's controversial. is that an Australian chicken or a British one?
That's a very much an organic, pre-arranged British chicken.
Okay, very good. And Mark, what about you?
Goose.
Goose? We've never had goose before.
I highly recommend it.
Goose and the gander. Maybe duck, but goose? Wow. That's from a different place. Very good. And Ben?
It's pork to me.
Oh, wow. You guys are diverse in terms of your Sunday roast.
I think we've ever had those answers before. Maybe none of the others.
No, I'm not goose or pork. No, it's normally lamb or beef, so you guys are exceptional.
Right.
But that's good to hear.
We must be.
Is it roast pork or is it just pork roast?
just a pork roast. That's good by me. Yeah.
I was expecting a lobster and some prawns on the barbie and on the beach, to be honest.
Morecambe Bay prawns,
back on potty shrimp.
I'm not sure roast prawn is that nice.
No, I never had them myself.
Yeah, indeed. Very good. Just to wrap up, I mean, I think you've got a great project. And yes, to be patriotic about it, the government and also the public need to get behind this type of thing, because we desperately need it in the United Kingdom. You know, we really do desperately need it. It's not going to take a lot of financing, and quite obviously, based on the figures you've talked about, even just on the first project, which is Marham, it's incredibly cash generative and incredibly positive, and cash positive in terms of your ability to then move on to other projects to continue the process. And so, yeah, all I can say is I wish you luck, guys. And As a giveaway, we are invested. We invested in the IPO. So we want you to do well. And we want you to do well because we need the gas as well.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, and we'll say Ben Clube, Mark Steves, and Ben Hodges of Energy Pathways. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So let's move on to our second guest this week, Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Welcome back, Sean. Happy New Year. Hope you had a good one.
Hi, Phil. Thanks very much for having me on the Sunday roast again. And Happy New Year to yourself, Phil, and Kevin.
Yeah. Did you have a good one, Sean? What did you get up to? Did you have a bit of downtime?
Did get a bit of downtime, which was pleasant. It's our summer here in Australia, so there's a lot of going down south where it's a few degrees cooler and around the beach.
Excellent. Tell us, Sean, before we go into Greatland Gold and the story that we want to talk about, which is an overview of Greatland Gold, what are you thinking about the world at the minute? You heard us waxing lyrical at the start there about fish shops not having fish because of Russia and problems between Iran and Pakistan, and Gaza's getting blown to pieces from Israel, and we've got supposed democracy in the US, and we've also got votes happening in the UK as well. Give us your view.
Yeah, look, the geopolitics is really unstable globally right now. And it's an amazing year of elections. You've had Taiwan, but you've got the UK, you've got the USA, obviously. But there's just a huge number of synchronized elections in 2024 in the world's liberal democracies. And I think that creates a certain level of potential uncertainty. And I think that's adding to that kind of overall sense of geopolitical risk. And then there's a couple of hotspots. Obviously, the Gaza, Israel, Hamas thing is off the chart. You know, Russia invading Ukraine's possibly worse. And then, you know, you continue to have this really irresponsible approach by China, who, you know, I think Australian divers were in the water recently and they came and sonared them at close range, which is an incredibly dangerous thing to do. So you just have all these very uncertain things. Yeah, I enjoy following geopolitics. The US election, I find kind of gobsmacking, albeit I still don't think Trump can motivate a majority of the electorate to be re-elected president, but he does. He seems to have captured, you know, one quarter of that electorate. But it's probably good for gold, that level of uncertainty, but it'd be nice just to get back to a normal world again, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I was listening to a podcast, actually, and this comes down to sort of social media and the fact that we're in this constantly connected state, 24/7 rolling news. And one of the things that struck me was apparently in the 2020s, in one day, we hear more tragedy than we would in 25 years in the 1990s. So that just shows you how much, I'm not saying that things that, you know, that more things are happening, but are we living in a time when actually this is normal? You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? It's like wars have gone on, and he's saying that it's actually safer to be born now than it was in the last past 75 years.
Well, it is hard to find a period of time where there hasn't been a war going on somewhere. Yeah. So I don't think the number of active conflicts are particularly different today than has been historically. I agree with you. I think the 24-hour news coverage coupled with social media really amplifies these things. And you also have the headline, you know, that constantly people are trying to refer to things as crisis to get headlines and clicks. There's also, I think it was in the original George Bush period, there was a pretty innocuous piece of change to US regulations around media, which stopped equal content laws, where you had to, the news had to present both sides of an argument in about equal measures. And that seemed like quite a sensible thing to repeal. But what it did lead to is the bifurcation of the US news, with a right wing, let's call that Fox Media, and a left wing, I think it's right to call that CNN. And I think that is unhealthy to have a society where people with one view tend to tune into one source of news, and people with a different view tend to tune into a different station for their news. I think it was a far more healthy environment where everyone was using more common news sense. And sure, you might interpret it different, you might emphasize things differently, but I think the bifurcation of where people get their information and then the way algorithms feed back what you're already thinking, I think is perhaps making some people more polarized than used to be. And that might be the difference from 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think that is a very good point, isn't it? It's because our narrative, anything that we click, is then reinforced by what we get on all social media. And even when we talk about things within Telegram groups, you get the polarizing effect of many people either agreeing with you or disagreeing with you. You know, but in the main, it is people agreeing with your point of view. So then you get the herd mentality and, you know, you get extremes on both sides. So, yeah, it's crazy situation. And we're definitely being manipulated more than we ever have been. And we don't realize it.
Yeah. And I'm not necessarily sure if there's some masterful person, you know, manipulating things. But I think the nature of algorithms, an unattended consequence is a change or a manipulation to the information you receive.
Okay, so now we've put the world to right. So which we obviously looked at the Havieron mineral resource estimate update at the back end of last year. Talk us through what you're working towards in the next 6 months to year and what listeners and shareholders can look forward to, please, Sean.
Yeah, well, look, thanks for mentioning the resource update. That was, yeah, I thought tremendous, up to 8.4 million ounces, and the pace of growth in this ore body has been maintained. So as we look into the calendar year 2024, you know, for me, it's a year of milestones. We'd like to get down to the top of the ore body. We'd like to complete the feasibility study. And I think those are huge milestones. So in the short term, we have the Ernst Giles drilling, which should come out in this March quarter. Really excited about that. It's taken us a number of years to get on there, and we're keen to get those results back and likely do some further drilling in calendar 2024. We are if I got turned to Havieron, we are presently dewatering, and to my understanding, that's progressing well. And you know, I think the information I have to date is probably more positive, a little bit ahead of schedule, so that's great. And you know, so once we complete that dewatering and depressurization work, we can then push that decline, that last kind of 20% into the top of the ore body. So I think those things are all really exciting for us in 2024 as we kind of, you know, bring the development of Havieron to its conclusion.
So with all this geopolitical situation, probably the strength of the Australian dollar is pretty good as well, I would imagine. How do you see the outlook for gold in itself?
Well, sorry, just on that, the Aussie dollar is actually, when it's risk off, the Aussie dollar tends to fall. The Aussie dollar is actually relatively low, and relatively low to its average since it was floated back in 1983. So you actually have a perfect environment for an Aussie gold producer, which is, I think, a fantastic gold price. And yeah, and it continues to trade above US 2000 an ounce. But then when you overlay that with an Aussie dollar trading at less than 70 cents, you actually get a Australian dollar gold price, which is outstanding, because the lower the Australian dollar, the Aussie dollar to the US greenback, the more Aussie dollars an ounce of gold translates into it. So even though you've got US gold just sitting a bit above $2,000 an ounce, Aussie gold, Australian dollar gold, is over $3,000 now. It is eye-wateringly good. So, yeah, I think the geopolitics supports gold. I think you increasingly see funds want some gold in their portfolio. And right now, with that geopolitical risk also on the Aussie, you're seeing the Aussie dollar, it's not weak. It's within a reasonably tight range to that 70-cent average. But it is below the curve, which just amplifies the benefit of the Aussie dollar. So it looks good. And I love the fact that we've got some copper in there as well. So we feel the commodity mix is the right commodities at the right time.
Yeah. And I mean, from the point of view of gold, I mean, I'm a bit of a gold bull in terms of all these geopolitical problems. And also, I feel that the dollar is going to lose some more value this year, even though it's made another effort at going back up again. And I can see we're going to get 2.2, 2.3, 2.4, 2.5 US dollar price for gold. And mainly on the back of the fact that many, many governments are stockpiling gold because their currencies are under threat.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right, Kevin. The buying by central banks around the world is a tremendous tailwind for the gold price, and there just doesn't seem to be any insight for that.
So going back to Greatland as a whole, you know, what do you see in 2024 as both catalysts, and what do you see that could cause you a headwind? Obviously, the elephant in the room in terms of headwind is how all of this merger situation plays itself out for you guys. So, you know, give us an idea of both of those things.
Well, look, actually, one of the things I did want to raise, so I think some people following the media will have an interest in this. You've seen at Telfer that there was an issue with their tailings dam facility there. So that means that they're continuing to mine, but they're actually stockpiling and not processing right now. And I have had a huge number of people ask me, well, what does that mean for Havieron? Well, it doesn't really mean anything. You know, this is a Telfer asset. It's to the account of now Newmont. They're a global entity of great capacity. And, you know, they've made it very clear publicly that they will make sure that that's corrected to a very high standard. And just to be clear, it's just some observed cracking. There hasn't been a spill or anything, but they're an incredibly prudent and measured and thoughtful organization. So I think that's something that people probably would be interested to hear about. And I think that being resolved in, say the next 6 weeks or so, I think will give everyone a lot of comfort. And to be honest, giving the facility a bit of an overview and a bit of an overhaul is probably really positive for its long-term duration. So I think, in terms of your question on how does that all play out, well, ultimately, I think Newmont's going to spend some time understanding its new asset base. And I think that plays out in 12, 24 months' time, whether they fall in love with it or not. We can understand why they would. Equally, we can understand they're such a big organization, they can't keep everything. But I think that's probably a bit of a slow burn. And I can't think of a better partner to develop Havieron with us and integrate it into the Telfer hub. And in parallel, I think it's just us continuing to walk forward. Development is rarely spectacular, but it's almost a situation of no news is good news. We just continue to slowly progress things, tick things off. Dewatering is not an exciting process, but it's important. It's important to do it well. And every day, every week, every month that we dewater takes us a step closer to the bottom of the ore body.
So from that perspective, do you see that Great and Gold will be producing gold and producing ore, or producing ore and producing gold is the right order, obviously, long before any decision is made about whether the main guys keep the asset?
Oh, look, it's hard for me to be drawn conclusively on that, because in all honesty, we don't know the minds of Newmont, and we don't know what their process will be to in terms of the sequence of understanding their assets and making a long-term strategic decision about each. But I think either outcome is good. I'd be rapt if we get an opportunity to buy back the farm, as I might describe it. I would understand it if they fall in love with us and we get a takeover bid. I'd be disappointed personally, but that creates value for shareholders and potentially significant shareholders. And I think having Wyloo there helps us capture fair, if not full, value for that. And then in terms of timing, that will play itself out, and we respect the Newcrest team to do that. But I think they'll ultimately be decisive. I think they'll ultimately make a decision one way or the other. But whether that decision is made in 6 months or 3 years, it's very hard to talk with any degree of certainty.
Though you will go into politics at some point, Sean, but I like your
diplomatic answer.
Yeah, I mean, it is very difficult. I accept there's no way that anyone's going to say, yes, well, this is when it's going to happen, that's when it's going to happen. But just from the time scales you gave, that you thought it could be the next couple of years, at the end of the day, if that happens, then, Great Lakes should be a gold producing country at that stage. And, that would be an interesting perspective. I mean, it's interesting that you said takeover, but I'm assuming you mean effectively they would buy Havieron as an asset, because they wouldn't surely be interested in all the other stuff that you have.
Oh, look, I think those kind of conversations are often tax-driven and what is the best interest of shareholders. Because if you did, let's just say, sell the asset, you would then want to return, if not all, certainly the great bulk of that cash back to shareholders and potentially ask for it back if you have a great idea. But so often those things, in my experience, are driven by tax-type considerations. So it's probably a reasonable thing for you to observe, though, there, Kevin. I probably used it in a generic sense. It could be an asset transaction. It could be a takeover, but ultimately, normally the target's trying to drive that to optimize the post-tax outcome for a shareholder, in our case, sitting in the UK. And I think, to give you a little bit of color, no one would be more happy than me or more excited if we get the opportunity to buy it back. Even though I gave you the diplomatic answer, I think it's okay for me to also say, people should absolutely be understand that we have built a team to run this asset, to be a good owner of this asset. That is the opportunity that we'd be incredibly excited to have.
Yeah, and I mean, with a partner such as Wyloo, these guys have got deep pockets to actually come up with the cash to be for you to actually effectively run the whole Telfer complex would probably be wonderful for them and also for you as a company.
No, that's a very fair observation. I think one of the reasons we were so pleased to bring Wailu on board, and it was multifactorial, but I think they enhance the credibility of Greatland as a counterparty in a whole range of scenarios, but including the one we've just been talking about.
Just while we're on the subject of sort of takeovers and M&A, what do you make of the current M&A activity and it potentially set to accelerate? Because we saw some news, I think it was Marathon Gold, wasn't it, that they were taken over by Calibre Mining. And then there was also an announcement of Osino Resources taken over by Dundee Precious Metals. And do you think that there's going to be a spike in that sort of M&A activity over the coming years?
Yeah, I think we are about to go through a cycle of some consolidation. I think there's been a across the board, without talking about any companies in particular, you've seen some pullback on share prices. So you can see fundamental value there that perhaps you can't see at the top of the cycle. And the investment bankers who come through our office, that talk to us about the environment right now are certainly all giving off the impression that there's a lot of people looking, a lot of people thinking about things, a lot of preliminary discussions. So I think you are probably going through these kind of conditions are often associated with a spike in M&A activity. And particularly when you have a bellwether transaction like Newmont's successful acquisition of Newcrest, that can often a number of additional transactions in the market. And I think it was really well received for Newmont. So that always gives directors and boards right through the sector a bit of a feeling of comfort that the market will reward, but certainly not punish, sensible acquisition opportunities.
Yeah, it seems for sure that this mega merger, if you like, is going to spark a collection of other things that will come from it. And by that divesting and also just the fact that this big deal's been done, more can be done. But moving away from that slightly, because we've talked about Greatland Gold as a gold play, but we know for sure it's not just a gold play, it's a gold and copper play. So tell us your thoughts on copper in general, worldwide, and then give us a bit of meat on the bone in terms of Greatland's copper situation.
I think copper is the best way to play this kind of electrification cycle, which incorporates electric vehicles, etc. Because really, I think what you can be confident about is there will be an increasing use for electricity, and the transport of that electricity, be it within an electric car or across a grid or from a turbine, wind turbine into the grid. And whilst some metals these kind of future metals, you have to predict what the future technology will be. Will it be lithium? Will it be some other metal that is used? And you've seen, I think someone told me that lithium is off 90%. Now that's clearly a very volatile sector when it can swing from great highs to great lows. And I don't have an opinion. It's a very light material, which makes some sense for it to be in high energy battery use for mobile vehicles, probably less so for stationary batteries. But I think what's tremendous about copper is you get this across the board exposure to that trend. There may be some smaller metals that have higher highs and lower lows, but I think copper is one of just those mainstream kind of GDP exposed or correlated metals. And I think the electrification cycle really suits it on top of that. So I think it's a great way to play the electrification kind of story. And I think it's a great way to do that without having to try to pick winners, but really just being very confident that you're going to have that exposure. And that's what I love about it for Greatland. If I was to pick two commodities to have exposure to, gold and copper are probably the two I'd choose. So we are incredibly fortunate to have that. And I think also when I think of Greatland, or I think of Havieron as a multi-decade asset, you get the opportunity to go through the cycle. So if you do feel, well, copper hasn't had the run you might have thought it's had for the last 3 years, well, that's fine, because we'll have 20 years or 30 years to find the highs of that market. And that I think is also hugely advantageous to have mine life, because it allows you to have confidence that you'll have time to experience those highs.
Yeah, and from a Gradient point of view, then where is the copper going to come from? And, you know, what exploration situations have you still got on the cards for copper?
So if you look at the portfolio of a lot of gold players in Western Australia, which are centered around those Archean greenstones, they don't have copper in their portfolio. They're just 100% gold. And that's not to say they're not great assets. But what I love about the Paterson is you have both copper and gold found together. So we have that competitive advantage over our Australian peer group, or over our West Australian peer group, is typically we'll have in the Paterson gold copper asset, albeit we hope to be successful in Australia's, and that will likely be gold only, because those Archean greenstones, which is the bulk of the West Australian gold sector, are typically only gold assets.
And just to remind everybody, in terms of Havieron, what sort of percentage copper is available in Havieron as opposed to the gold?
So around 20 to 25% of the value is in copper. I give a range because depending on what gold price you use and what copper price you use, you can come out within that range. But typically, over the last couple of years, that range has been around 20 to 25% copper.
Okay, so with both the copper and gold situation in Havieron itself, and all the other opportunities in St. Giles, is it, and different other prospects that you've got going on this year, and the JV that you have now as well, it's a very exciting year ahead. And yeah, I'm looking forward to you sending me the big chunk of gold that you're going to send me in the post, either end of this year or early next year. But yeah. Good luck.
Thanks, Kevin and Phil. That was a good conversation as always, and really appreciate your interest in Havieron and Greatland.
Yeah. Well, so Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold, thanks very much for your time.
Bye now.
So let's move on to the movers and shakers of the week. The best mover of the week, or the last week, 5 days, was Strategic Minerals, SML, market cap of $3 million. They announced that a major client for its Cobre magnetite operation has returned with a significant new purchase order for 30,000 tonnes in 2024, a 50% increase over previous years. Shipments have already commenced under the new order, which includes faster bi-monthly billing and 15-day payment terms. Additionally, the company is in advanced talks with another potential large volume client that has already purchased a trial order. With a renewed business, Strategic Minerals expects an operational after-tax cash surplus in 2024 following a drop in sales in 2023 when the major client was absent. So that one's up about, I think it's about 70 or 80% on the week.
What actually is it that they're selling, and whereabouts is it?
So they're a profitable producing mineral company, and they've got a magnetite operation in New Mexico, USA. So another one in the US. I think they had a cash position of about $100,000 or something like that. They're in advanced talk with separate third-party companies, and they've got a tailings operation. But they've also got another asset in basically Cornwall. It's 100% owned subsidiary Cornwall Resources, and the University of Exeter's Camborne School of Mines, in which CRL and Cornish Lithium were delivery partners, was funded by the European Regional Development Fund. So basically the assets in New Mexico, and also projects in Cornwall as well. So I think it moved on the week, yeah, it was 75% up, but it's still only a $3.5 million market cap company. So it's good to see a bit of attention back into these very small nano caps.
Yeah, well, it seems obvious that they're going to be cash positive now and probably profitable.
Yeah. Next one was Thor Energy. That was up 56%. They had a uranium update that was announced on the 18th of this week. 100% owned Wedding Bell and Radium Mountain projects located in the Vanadium Mining District of Southwest Colorado, USA. There's some news out, so good to see. Uranium seems to be the hot one right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, pun intended. Uranium, way over the 100 now. It's about 106. I don't know quite how that works out financially, but obviously it's much higher. And I'm looking forward to the UEE IPO as well. They've got a lot of assets in the US. I think it is either US or Canada, I'm not sure. And that's coming out of Power Metals. So Power Metals hasn't responded at all, obviously, to this Russian uranium. And yet they obviously have uranium assets. So
It hit $100 on the pound spot price, which is, I think, was a 16-year high for the commodity. And they're saying that the forecasting into 2024 that it will just be a continued growth on favourable fundamentals, and obviously current supply shortages affecting major producers. So, it'd be interesting to see how, as you say, things like UEE comes to market with the valuation. And there's not that many, is there? I think we went through a little analysis, didn't we, on how many companies are actually on the market in the UK that are uranium. Obviously, you've got Thor, Power Metals with the exposure, UEE, who are going to be soon, hopefully, listed in sort of Q1, Q2 of 2024 of this year. And then you've also got Neo Energy Metals, which is one of Jason Brewer's as well, isn't that, I believe?
Yeah, that's right. And that's another interesting play. So we'll see how that one plays out. Yeah, they're actually near production, and they could be incredible.
Yeah. So the other one that had a good RNS this week and moved quite well, and we'll check where it finished the week on. In fact, it finished the week at 2.05 pence, up some 25%, was Genflow Biosciences. They announced that they'd secured two research grants from Belgium's New Technological Innovation Partnership. Grants are significant, with a total value of approximately 2.9 million euros over 3 years. The first research program, focused on sarcopenia in collaboration with Revitis SA, has been generously funded with a grant of 1.34 million euros. And the second, in partnership with ExoBiologics, is supported by a grant of 1.55 million euros and focuses on mRNA delivery using exosomes. These research initiatives are part of a broader innovation partnership with a budget of 81 million euros, representing a substantial commitment to advancing medical research and development in the region. So what do you make of that in terms of, you know, the market cap sitting there around 6 million at the current share price, grants for circa 3 million, let's round it up to 3 million over 3 years. How do you value a company like that now?
I don't know, it is at the minute anyway, by the looks of things. I mean, I think they've got a runway of about 18 to 24 months in terms of cash, just for normal products, before this sort of these grants. I don't think there's any doubt that if this was listed in the US as a biotech, it would be 10 times its value, at least, maybe more.
Yeah.
You know, Eric, who is the major shareholder in Genflow, has said as much. He's got some incredible people working there. And, you know, they have found an ability to increase length of life with good quality of health. And that's going to have a positive impact. Now, obviously, at the minute, it's only been proven in animals. But as time goes by and that gets to human trials over the next year to 2 years, then, you know, it could be the sky's the limit in terms of this one. It really could.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to the next one. Prospects Energy had an announcement early Friday morning. The share price went up about 5%, but it was good to see it actually moving positively anyway. They provided a positive operational update from the Pradera Maya well site in the Selva field, with continued strong gas production as expected. Pole Valley Energy's limited subsidiary, Pole Valley Operations, which operates the Selva Malvezzi production concession, confirmed optimal well performance following commissioning and testing. So great to see them, that well there, optimized and confirmed great performance again. This was one of our 12 stock picks. Seems to have been sold off from crazy highs earlier, sort of towards the middle of last year. And now we sit at the 5.7 pence mark with, you know, an offtake with BP Marketing sales for the aforementioned well there. And the share price sits languishing at some sort of sub 20 million market cap for a company with producing assets in a safe jurisdiction. So another one that kind of defies logic in terms of the valuation.
Yeah, and obviously the big news there in the next month or two, or however long this takes, is going to be the licenses, or the additional licenses for the Selva field, which could effectively, I think, increase production by 3 or 4-fold. So there's a huge amount of potential, and they're not coming back to the market for cash anytime soon because they've got revenue. They talked before Christmas, I think, about possibly buying another asset.
Identify another asset.
On a buy-in thing, that was in the RNS. So, yeah. I can't disagree with anything you're saying. So it's like, why?
Okay, so the other one was that had an announcement Friday morning was Vesarion, which is the graphene ware company who had sort of deals with Umbro for their technologies with this special strength of graphene. And basically, they had a placing where they issued half a billion shares, that's 500 million new ordinary shares,
at a price of 0.08 pence per share, a 50% discount to the previous day closing price. £400,000 were raised. I don't know whether it's a lights on raise to keep lights on. This follows another raise in November, only 2 months ago or 3 months ago, where they also did a raise of similar amount, £454,000, at a price way, way higher than this at 0.275. So just feels like the company is issuing, and they've effectively, by issuing those half a billion shares, they've diluted the company by issuing more shares now in this round than there are total shares in the company at sort of 496 million. So I don't know. I just makes you wonder how companies like this can survive in this market when they're having to dilute so much. They forget these were trading at 5p back in March.
Well, yeah, I think the company can survive, but the shareholders will not. I mean, the shareholders must be hanging on by the skin of the teeth, and you know, they're being diluted to oblivion. But you know, maybe it comes good. It's one of these new techs, isn't it? Ultimately, with the graphene, so we will see. But yeah, 5p to 0.08 pence is quite a drop.
Yeah. So then there was another one, unfortunately, the appointment of administrators from, do you remember we talked about AMT Power? You know, they came to market at, like, the valuation was something like 150, 200 million, maybe even higher than that. You know, your 52-week high is 68 pence, and they were trading lows at 0.425. And unfortunately, as I say, the announcement came late Friday that they had to appoint the administrators. The basically, they've come in, they've been suspended from trading on AIM. WH Ireland have resigned as Nomad to the company, which is obviously always a bit of a death knell, really, isn't it? But sad to see these companies, isn't it, that have these multi hundred million valuations, and they can't even make it on the markets, you know?
Yeah, whether it's solely these markets or actually the plan was just not a very good plan, because there definitely is stocks that are not working because the ability to have capital is not there.
Yeah.
But there are also stocks that are badly run, and the ideas were not very good.
Yeah, I mean, they only came to market at the sort of to March 2021, and they raised about 12 million, 13.7 million before expenses on their initial, when they came to the market to AIM, and they had a valuation of £61 million, which equated to a 1.75 pence per share.
Scary.
It is scary.
Scary. And, you know, there are risks in everything that we're doing in terms of this part of the market, and everybody needs to be aware of that.
Yeah.
And everybody needs to be aware that they are taking risks, and it's high risk, high reward with near enough all of the stock.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say is that when these stocks get into a cash flow positive situation, then normally they do well from that point on. Maybe not share price straight away.
Yeah.
But as time goes by, they start to progress.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, with some of our choices like Prospect Energy, Jubilee, Till Brands.
Let's move on to have a quick look, and we'll keep this one very short. Is a bit of financial news markets. Obviously, we saw FTSE fell earlier in the week based on the fact that they announced the annual rate of inflation had actually risen. It only gone from the previous announcement was that it was 3.9% in the 12 months of November, and it rose by 0.1% to 4% in the year to December, and then a fall to 3.8% had actually been expected. So it was due to drop back to 0.1%, but it swung the wrong way on the 0.1%. But that they put that down to alcohol and tobacco duties or increasing the price of that, which obviously affected the inflation. But so that was a bit of a surprise. The Christmas shopping numbers were down at the retail levels. I think that was they said that was down to Black Friday, you know, the November discounts, which brought a lot of shoppers shopping earlier than normal, getting the bargains in the November sales. And it brought it down to COVID level lockdown numbers in terms of retail. So December retail was down on that. What do you make of those numbers?
I wonder whether the retail is you know, the high street still not doing so well, but, you know, I'd like to see what was spent online, because I would imagine that is still going up, because everybody's still, I mean, anything I'm buying online. I'm not going to a shop. Why would you want to go to a shop? You know, I know it seems a bit bizarre now, but it's true. Like,
people don't go to shops.
I'm just the same. It's easy to just hit the button, isn't it? Buy Amazon, buy online, use online just for the ease of it and have it delivered to your door. But I actually quite like going into towns and going to independent and trying to support the independent, you know, bakers, record stores, you know, bookstores, because ultimately, you know, can you imagine not having a high street? Because for me, a part of that whole enjoyment of shopping sometimes is to just have a mooch around the shops and buy something on spec. Oh, that looks good. It's just nice to support them as well, not just because Amazon ain't paying taxes, are they? I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, I do like going shopping sometimes, but the vast majority of the stuff is not going to be bought that way. And I think going forward, your high streets are going to have to be repurposed for something else. You know, is the high street going to actually be really just full of restaurants and bars and places that we go and socialize in rather than necessarily buy things? Because many of the high streets have got lots of charity shops now because, you know, the people who own the properties are getting rents or rates rebates when they can't rent them. So the charity shops are going in there instead and paying very low rents. And, you know, there's many shops that are not occupied as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's only the beginning, really. And I mean, the whole virus thing, I think, just exasperated that and probably increased the rate of it happening.
So FTSE, for the week, FTSE lost 2.1%, third successive weekly loss. FTSE 250 lost 1.7%, and the AIM all share returned 1.8%. So slightly up on the AIM all share small caps.
I think my feeling is that there's been a bit of a January sale going on, and after this January sale, hopefully this really is the bottom, and we're going to spring up from that. But I think there's a couple to watch next week anyway. I would definitely watch Genflow. I think it's got great potential from this price. It's way too cheap in my view. And yeah, there are many others that I think will waiting on news. And there's a lot of people also talking about copper in Zambia, and there are many options there. You've got ARC Minerals with joint venture. You've got Askom Pioneer with a joint venture. You've got Extract with Lamina. You've got TYM. You've got Tertiary Minerals there with LAN. You've got Jubilee Metals who are progressing with the copper. And I think there's more and more business being done in Zambia as well from speaking to couple of CEOs this week. You know, stuff is
there's also a lot of investment
in the wings.
There's a lot of investment going into that country as well, with the likes of IRH but going into the Mopani mines. You've got Jubilee Metals there with, you know, the Mufulira and the Mopani slag project. So there's a lot of investment going on, and we've seen a lot of other companies, Chinese, moving in. They've just moved into that area. They've moved into Botswana as well. So it is good to see these large multinationals moving into different jurisdictions, and especially the likes of Zambia, Namibia, Botswana. So yeah, Africa looks poised for it this year and next year. But I think on that note, we've talked long enough. Two special guests this week, two companies on. Obviously, you know, it'd be good to hear your feedback on them. If you like what you've heard, hit the subscribe button and hit the bell icon so you receive any further notifications of any future episodes. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.